This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. Before we get into today's topic, I want to give a brief thank you to this program's previous host, Jay Shell, who pioneered Wilderness and Wildlife in 2018 and has hosted and managed it for the past 7 years. Jay's dedication to public outreach in matters of wildlife and ecology is admirable, and we wish him the very best in all his future endeavors. Today, we are interviewing Tara Zuardo, a senior advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. Tara works on protecting endangered species and their habitats throughout North America as part of the Center's Endangered Species Program. Prior to joining the Center, Tara ran her own private law practice focusing on projects including endangered species and wildlife protection, and the regulation of wildlife-friendly, wildfire-resilient housing initiatives. For 7 years, she was also an attorney for the Animal Welfare Institute, working on wildlife and endangered species campaigns like protecting the world's last wild red wolves and fighting harmful wildlife trapping practices. She holds degrees from Lewis and Clark Law School and the University of California at Berkeley. She has authored publications on animal law, wildlife policymaking, and the U.S. legal system in its relation to endangered species. Tara, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Of course. So just to get us started, could you tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to work at the Center for Biological Diversity?
Sure. So animal protection was always kind of a passion starting in high school. And law school, you know, which kind of trains you in a few different areas, including litigation, legislation, advocacy, it kind of seemed like the best way to move the needle on a broad versus individual scale, so to speak, especially since it afforded me the ability to study the Endangered Species Act, which is one of the most effective conservation laws in the United States and has an incredible rate of success in avoiding extinction. In my first real animal and wildlife law position at the Animal Welfare Institute, I found myself partnering with folks at this center quite often on projects because of their willingness to push for kind of what's right for the species, their philosophical approach to protecting nature, kind of combined with how smart their staff were, their expertise, how well they treat their staff, their impressive background history of their work, all of that really made it an easy decision to eventually come and work here once I felt confident enough that I was experienced enough to do so.
Even before your time at the Center for Biological Diversity, you have an extensive history as an advocate and lawyer for wildlife. Are there any projects that have stood out as especially formative to your current understanding and approach to your work?
Yes. You know, I think probably the case that was nearest and dearest to my heart was the Red Wolf case. I worked on that from 2011 to 2018. This is the only population of red wolves in the whole world. They were reintroduced as what's known as under the Endangered Species Act as a 10J species, which is where they're taken out of the wild because they're about to disappear, to bred in captivity, and then they're ideally introduced back into the landscape. So back in 2011, the population was down to about 40 individuals that were left, which is pretty dire, all of them living in North Carolina. Now we're down to about 20. They're very easily mistaken for coyotes and are shot by mistake. And then they're also vulnerable to other threats like vehicle strikes. So back in 2011, the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission was already allowing for daytime hunting of coyotes in the Red Wolf areas, which is just a disaster. People were calling in mistaken identities. I shot what I thought was a coyote. It turned out to be a red wolf, all of that. But that year, they proposed a night hunting season of coyotes in the Red Wolf areas, which would have completely wiped them out. Mm. So we sued and won in blocking all coyote hunting, daytime and nighttime, in the areas where they lived and roam. And now the center is kind of doing what I would call kind of the campaign follow-up. Even after you win a case, you still have to work hard to protect the species, because just winning the case often is not kind of the end all be all, right? You have to make sure you follow up with the species. You have to do public education and outreach. You have to address other threats that weren't addressed in the lawsuit. So the center is now focusing on getting wildlife corridors in place, protecting them from vehicle strikes, which, it's my understanding, has kind of emerged as the biggest threat now that kind of coyote hunting has been eliminated there. So it's kind of a perfect example of how you have to work on a species for a lifetime, not just sue once and you're done.
Sure. Yeah. And the
because of the complexity of protecting endangered species, the center seems to have quite a diverse palette when it comes to the type of work they do.
Yes.
How does the Center for Biological Diversity's Endangered Species Program conduct its work, and what role as a senior advocate do you play in that?
Yeah, so I would say kind of historically the program has kind of had its major successes through three main areas: listing petitions, litigation, and advocacy. So they secure protections not only for the species but for critical habitat, and that's kind of going to be an important backdrop of our discussion today, is just you species can't survive without habitat, just like we can't survive without a home. So the center has gotten more than 750 species listed under the Endangered Species Act and over 700 million acres of critical habitat protected. This is massive, right? Because only once you're listed and once you get that protection, does all the other protections kind of kick in, and can we hold agencies accountable and make sure that projects aren't kind of threatening their existence? So, and this also includes not just kind of getting the species protected, getting their critical habitat protected, but kind of fighting off some of the worst, most dangerous politically motivated attempts to weaken kind of our core environmental laws, because a lot of them work together as well. Like the National Environmental Policy Act kind of complements the Endangered Species Act in terms of taking a look at what the impacts of a project are going to be on the environment before an agency makes kind of headway on that project, or whatever the federal nexus is on that project. So some of the kind of fascinating, amazing, notable success stories behind the center's endangered species program include like the California condor, the black-footed ferret, bald eagles, grizzly bears, sea turtles, and jaguars. As a senior advocate, I work on species protection from a lot of different angles, as I mentioned, a kind of holistic campaign strategy. So you can't always just sue to protect a species. You sometimes have to follow up with legislation, lobbying, public outreach and education, petitions, comments, placing pressure on governments, placing pressures on private companies in order to kind of work on an issue successfully and protect them in the long term. So, for example, you could get a species listed for protection, and then Congress could just delist it, in spite of kind of what the best available science indicates, because that is within Congress's purview to do that. You could win on litigation, and then any form of legislation could kind of undo that win for the species. So, there's all of that kind of long-term looking out for and approaching an issue from a lot of different perspectives and strategies. And then what we do isn't always defensive work. We also have to find ways of moving the needle forward on some issues. So, for example, moving away from the use of barbaric, outdated practices that are dangerous for threatened and endangered species, as well as a lot of other wildlife, pets, and the public, such as, you know, allowing for unregulated trapping on public lands, or allowing for government agencies to use poison on our public lands, and how this affects keystone species that are so incredibly important to biodiversity, improving our water quality, creating habitat for other species, such as beavers. So that's kind of the full spectrum of what I look at as a campaigner and as an advocate, is how do I get at this issue using a bunch of different methods that are going to be best for the species in the long run.
Well, I imagine there are near infinite nuances in approaching that problem from species to species. What would you say are the most proponent current challenges to the protection of endangered species today?
So this administration is most definitely, in and of itself, just the biggest challenge to protecting endangered species. And I think from many of our laws, just blatant, flagrant violation of these laws is a huge issue, and kind of holding them accountable in court and then making sure that they listen to court orders and actually follow the law. So, probably one of the most notable issues that has come up in the last 5 months has been the Trump's administration to weaken the Endangered Species Act by removing the regulatory definition of harm. Now, that may sound benign, but it's a huge problem. So, if you take out the definition of harm from our Endangered Species Act regulations, which is how our agencies implement the regulations, right? It's kind of like the guidance and how they approach endangered species protection. It's key to the interpretation and enforcement of that law. So the definition has long included harm to habitat, any significant habitat modification or degradation that will kill or injure wildlife. Congress recognized that habitat destruction was the primary cause of species decline when it passed the Endangered Species Act. It's also just in keeping that interpretation is also just in keeping with the plain language and intent of the Endangered Species Act, if you read the wording, and was already upheld by the Supreme Court in 1995. So, as I've mentioned, without a home, species can't live. So by removing the definition of harm, it's an attempt to nullify significant protections of the act. Now, without that definition, we can still bring what's called Section 9 to take litigation on the Endangered Species Act, because, like I said, we can just point to the plain language of the law and the intent to the court and say, obviously, the intent here was to include critical habitat, damage to habitat, modification, as that harms the species. However, removing the definition could come to harm other processes that are kind of an integral part of how the Endangered Species Act works. So, for example, what's known as Section 7 consultation under the law, or the analysis of whether and to what extent a given project's going to harm a species. These kinds of issues and what the agency decides is officially harm comes up in some pretty key and important documents that often will determine whether a project proceeds and how it proceeds. So biological opinions, habitat conservation plans, plans to mitigate harm associated with any given project. When you don't have that definition of harm as kind of your guiding light, that kind of leaves it up to the agency to decide what they want to do and what they see as harm. And this is all part of our duty as federal agencies to ensure that actions that are taken or funded are not likely to jeopardize the species overall. So that's what kind of is going to be the most immediate impact of the regulation and the primary harm up front, that the services could presumably avoid taking into account harm to habitat as they engage in this Section 7 consultation and minimization measures. So ultimately, the biggest concern is that this could open up habitat to developers, loggers, miners, oil and gas interests, more exploitative interests that don't want any check or limitations or restrictions in place, which is what the clear intent here is with this administration. And then aside from this, there have been recent attacks to other important laws like the National Environmental Policy Act. You also have the White House reviewing kind of key Endangered Species Act rule changes, the designation of critical habitat, the listing of protected species, four elements of the law. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, one of his first official acts, issued a sweeping secretarial order under the umbrella title of Unleashing American Energy that targeted kind of many executive agency actions that were part of the Biden era Endangered Species Act regulations. So, for example, Endangered Species Act requires that decisions on whether a species is threatened or endangered be made, quote, solely on the basis of best scientific and commercial data available. Trump administration has engaged in some actions leading us to be concerned that a cost-benefit analysis might be published in the listing proposal process that would just be extremely detrimental and not in keeping with the law at all. They've also made a point of what's going after what's called the blanket rule, which extends the same protections against take that endangered species enjoy to threatened species. Well, without protection from take, threatened species would quickly slide towards extinction. So in general, we're seeing some pretty strong corrupt signs of plans for private interest giveaways in terms of allowing for take of listed species both already initiated and coming down the pipeline. And what's the point of all this? Well, slow down efforts to protect species under the guise of a non-existent energy crisis, open everything up to exploitation in spite of the public's kind of strong support for protecting endangered species and habitat. But there will be litigation over all of it, and that'll continue beyond Trump's terms.
Sure.
In terms of legislative specific threats, there's currently legislation proposed to delist grizzly bears. There's been steps to rescind decades old policy to restrict road building and timber harvest on national forest lands, known as the roadless rule. And like many other things that Trump is dismantling, it's going to cost a lot of taxpayer money to try and get us back to the status quo once this kind of reign of destruction is over. The roadless rule was issued to make government more efficient by not building roads in sensitive areas when we already have tons of roads that we can't afford to maintain. So rescinding the rule is going to result in government waste, environmental harm, and that's all going to be at the taxpayers' expense.
Sure. I understand that the administration has also been delaying protections for endangered species, like the California salamanders as an example. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. So we haven't seen many species at all get listed since January. We did enter into a settlement agreement with Fish and Wildlife Service in mid-January before Trump came on board, which mandates the Fish and Wildlife Service make decisions on certain imperiled species by certain dates. But yes, for those who are not covered by the settlement agreement, things have been slow to non-existent, even though the Endangered Species Act and its regulations are super clear about deadlines. So a few examples of what species we've had to sue over and just in the last couple months, because they really don't have any time left to wait. The Crater Lake Newt, Tecopa's Bird's Beak, Kern County and Relictual Slender Salamanders in California, and the Railroad Valley Toad, all of them very urgent situations.
Sure. Yeah. Getting into some of your own past work, much of your work in the Center for Biological Diversity over the past year or so has involved migratory bird protections, specifically involving a notable bird mortality event in Chicago's McCormick Center. Could you tell us a bit about this event and how it serves as a success story for wildlife-friendly infrastructure?
Sure. So building collisions serve as the second biggest threat to migratory birds in the world. We now know that they could be taking around 5 billion birds per year in North America alone. McCormick was an issue year after year after year for many years because it's right in the way of birds' migratory patterns, and it has massive glass facade, which was at times lit up at night. And so in October of 2023, during a massive migration event, thousands of victims of birds were collided with the building and were found as carcasses the next day. It sparked public outrage, not only at buildings like McCormick, which has the option to install bird-friendly building materials to prevent this kind of problem, like all buildings do, but also at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, whose job it is to come up with a consistent system to regulate this take and prevent this take in order to comply with our role, the United States, in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. In the same way, we have permitting systems for all of our environmental laws. We have incidental take permits under the Endangered Species Act, and all of this is designed to minimize take. So while exerting pressure on McCormick, we also petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to establish a permitting system to protect birds from window collisions. They had previously kind of started to come up with a plan. They reached out to the public and said, hey, we know we're not in compliance with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. We know we need to come up with a system. Give us your feedback. And then they just completely abandoned it. And so it's obvious there's not going to be an impetus towards installing these measures unless it's absolutely required by local and federal governments. And I think it's really important to point out that when only applied to new construction and only required for new construction, these measures are completely cost neutral. So there's really no reason not to move forward on this issue. And this includes local governments, not just our federal government. But in terms of proactive legislation that has come up very recently for migratory birds, in May, U.S. representatives introduced two bills that would help conserve birds, the Migratory Bird Protection Act and the Albatross and Petrel Conservation Act, which would build upon existing efforts to protect migratory birds and the most threatened seabird species. So Migratory Bird Protection Act would provide clarity on how the U.S. implements the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So, for example, as I just mentioned, it would ensure some regulatory certainty around what's considered foreseeable killing or incidental take, the killing of injured bird or injuring of birds by otherwise legal activities, i.e. operating your building. And then the Albatross and Petrel Conservation Act would help implement the International Agreement for the Conservation of Albatrosses and Petrels, which helps protect seabirds from international fishing threats.
Sure. Transitioning to another focus of the Center for Biological Diversity, the Southeast Oklahoma Power Core Reservoir Project. Could you tell us a bit about this project and what it would entail?
Sure. So this project involves an attempt to build a massive reservoirs and power facilities on nearly 1,500 acres of habitat in Southeast Oklahoma. If completing, the project would siphon off about 15% of the water from Kayamishi River, which is relied on by more than 30 species of freshwater mussels and 100 species of fish. So this includes three mussels that are protected under the Endangered Species Act and one species of protected mussel that is especially culturally important to the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, which would likely be driven extinct by the project. Essentially, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has rejected the application over and over again, three or four times total. Without even reaching an environmental analysis, the applicant has failed to comply with the basic Energy Regulatory Commission requirements for these applications. So the applicant would now have to file an appeal in federal court and would likely only have until 2027 to do so. So it does appear that for now the project has been stopped. There's always an option to kind of bring it back up, but it does appear that it has been blocked for now. I do think it's indicative of a bigger trend. I think we're seeing lots of what I would call somewhat haphazard applications related to energy projects that are not in compliance with our federal environmental laws, as well as proposed water diversion projects. All of a sudden, I'm getting calls from the Midwest from groups that are concerned about whooping cranes, Indiana bats, mussels, you name it, sturgeon, about proposed water diversion projects from these major rivers that would result in take that would endangered, threatened, and endangered species. And so I think the concept right now is let's push for as much exploitation as we can, even if it violates the law, because we have this brief Trump administration window to do it. So that's what I'm seeing in terms of patterns that are a little bit alarming. I mean, the Federal Register notices every day proposed pipelines, interstates, highways, terminals, gas stores, projects, oil and gas leasing, hydroelectric projects, mining projects, plutonium pits, just like I've never seen before. And I do think it's coming from this build, 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 develop, let's exploit, let's get what we can in right now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Based on your extensive experiences advocating for and defending wildlife, what do you hope to see in a future of human and wildlife cohabitation?
I'm really hoping that we can come back from this incredibly dark time in human history. It's going to take a lot of work and money just to get us back to the status quo. Laws and regulations that we put in place over the last 50 years because they were needed, because mm-hmm. people were dying, because species were going extinct, rivers were catching on fire. Just getting back to getting by is going to be difficult. Not to mention all the damage that has been done to our climate change policies and our ability to mitigate those impacts and save ourselves, not just nature. I'm really hoping that people are going to take this as an opportunity to essentially better educate themselves about how the destruction of our natural world goes hand in hand with our own destruction. And this new knowledge will be reflected on our voting and our public policy choices. We've got a lot of work to do. I don't know how bad it has to get before we all open our eyes and realize what is truly needed in terms of public policy that is actually in the public interest. On a wish list basis, if we weren't going through a complete attack on our democracy, environment, and basic human rights right now, I would personally love to see the state step up and do more to protect wildlife and nature in their own backyard. State Endangered Species Acts that are robust, like that of California's and New York's, State Environmental Quality Acts that actually protect the environment and the public, even when the federal government isn't involved. I'm talking about initiatives from the states to actually step up and do what's right. Kind of like the California Environmental Quality Act was historically doing before it was recently weakened. Sure. Again, just to see the states kind of step up and do more. I would love to see that.
Yeah. What can listeners do to help support the Center for Biological Diversity's work and endangered species protections generally?
I think the easiest thing to do is just to keep a very close eye on our website right now. It's biologicaldiversity.org. Pay close attention to the action alerts and press releases in general. You can always donate to work as well, but honestly, pay attention to your legislative representatives and what they're doing. Not just federal representatives, but state and local city council as well. You know, stay informed, make your voice heard so that they know what their constituents actually want. You know, obviously, also, as everyone knows, your personal consumer choices are incredibly important. I'm talking about the importance of not using rodenticides, which can significantly harm wildlife, avoiding use of plastic, recycling, protecting wildlife habitats, participating in cleanups, making your home wildlife friendly, avoiding purchasing any products that could contain wildlife products in them, such as ivory or coral. Contributing your tourist dollars to wildlife and bird watching, and always advocating for funding and connecting with connection with protecting nature and wildlife. People don't realize just how empowered they are. But first and foremost, stay on your local legislators and make sure they're doing the right thing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Tara, that's about all I have for you today. Thank you so much again for joining us. I deeply appreciate all the work that you do for the Center for Biological Diversity and for sharing a little bit about it with us today. So thank you again.
Thank you, Ben. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Yeah, take care.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found at its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.